Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. Simply pour a can in your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more. Welcome back to Cutting the Distance. September is finally here. The bulls are starting to get fired up, and that's exactly what we're going to cover on today's episode is elk hunting during the rut. Our guest today is a coworker here at Meat Eater, and when I first talked to him, I could tell that he just gets it. He's a great elk hunter. He can talk to people that kind of buffalo their way through a conversation, but you know, we got chatting about elk hunting and things that I did versus things that he did, and you could just tell it clicked with him. He was born and raised in Montana and has spent the last 14 years guiding elk hunters, one in Colorado, 13 in Montana. And those were both on wilderness expeditions as well as private ranches and everywhere in between. He's going to be mad that I added this because I know he was joking when he sent this for his bio, but he said he has killed more shit than the plague was his last line in his bio. But today's guest is Corey Calkins, great elk hunter, and glad to have you on the show.
Yeah, what's up, Jason? Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Have you had a chance to get out in the woods yet?
Yeah, I went out. It was opening weekend this last weekend here in Montana. And got out. We had some beautiful weather. Actually, it was a little hot on opening day. And then some torrential rain came in the following Sunday and Monday over the Labor Day weekend. It was pretty quiet elk-wise in the woods. There were sure a lot of people getting after it. Some hunters, some just recreational dirt bikers, but it was loud in the woods. There's a lot of people making a lot of noise for sure.
Yeah, I've always loved and hated Labor Day because it's the start of elk season, but it's also like the last weekend for all the hikers and recreationalists aside from us hunters, and it just seems to pack every trailhead, every good area. Everybody's hiking everywhere, and it's the elk really aren't cranking. So it's a little bit of we're so anxious to get out in the woods, but yet it's not always like the most productive.
Absolutely. Yeah. Across the board that I've heard, not a lot of bugling action, elk still in their bachelor summer herds, summer locations. But man, it's going to change by the day here as we speak.
Yeah. I got to get out this weekend a little bit easier of a hunt because it was a rut hunt. And then the kid had drawn a rifle tag, but same thing. There were bulls around. They would answer bugles just enough so that we could keep tabs on them. But if I had a bow in my hand, I would be really, I wouldn't be real confident that I would be able to make anything happen. Just how, lackadaisical their bugles were, really wasn't interested. The herd bull didn't even show up in the herd until 8:30 in the morning. He was obviously out running ridges looking for other cows and whatnot, and then he kind of showed up and rolled into the group of about 40 cows. But yeah, still real big herds, and they haven't really got broken down yet, and bulls still running together. So it seems I don't want to say it's late, but it's not kicked off yet for sure.
Yeah, I don't know, the way this season, at least in the northern half of the Rockies, everything seems to be like a week late. I'm a big angler too, fly fisherman, and a lot of hatches were late. Rivers were high later than the, at least compared to the last couple of years. So one's got to wonder if things might be just a couple days or a week later in the elk rut this year. We'll see.
Yeah. I mean, we can get into this in a little bit, but I've always been that one, like, no, your excuse of the rut's late or your excuse of the moon or your excuse of, you know, they weren't bugling this year. Like, I've never bought into it, but one thing the last couple of years, and I don't know if I'm making my own excuses now, but I felt like it's been later. I don't know how, what I would attribute it to or what, but it seems like, man, they were still going a lot better into October than they have in the past, but may just be me making a weak excuse for myself.
Well, yeah, I don't know. October is still a great month. Those first 2 weeks to get after bugling elk.
Yeah.
They're still pretty fired up. A lot of people give up by then and man, it's not a good time to give up yet.
And one thing that I would like to point out, maybe it's not exactly true, but what I've noticed growing up hunting Roosevelts versus being able to the last 10 years hunt a lot of Rocky bulls is the rut truly is over somewhere. As soon as October rolls around, the elk know like Roosevelts were done. Mm-hmm. Where when I've got to hunt Rockies, you know, they're still bugling into the second, third week of October still a lot of times. And I don't know if it has to do with herd dynamics or areas or, you know, the health of the herd when they can come into estrus or whatnot. But that's one major difference I've known is that the Rockies seem to rut into October a lot further than the Roosevelts.
So yeah, our rifle season here in Montana opens, you know, around like the 20th through 28th-ish, fourth weekend in October. And I called in a bull for a client with the cow call that opening weekend of rifle season.
Nice. Yep.
Yeah.
So you never know. It's been good. Same thing with my wife when she had that tag. It was October 28th and on a rifle tag, and he bugled 300 times that afternoon. You know, once they got out of bed, bugled his whole way up before she was able to get a shot at him. It was just, you know, just nuts. I don't know if a cow came in late or what, but man, it reconstituted the rut there for at least an evening, and we took advantage of it. So, all right, now we're going to, like every show, we're going to jump into listener questions. It's funny, you know, as elk season gets close, we get all of these listener questions, and I like to take those or give them to my guests and let them answer them. If you have questions for me or my guests here at Cutting the Distance, please email them to us at ctd@phelpsgamecalls.com or hit us up on social media, send us messages, and we'll do our best to get them included. So our first question today comes from Holden Kuhn. A buddy and him are going to go on their first elk hunts this year. It's a rifle hunt. They both have tags. Assuming they're hunting and glassing together and they spot elk, how do you decide who shoots first? So me and my own buddies, I'll let you go first. We've always had our own system, but I'll let you answer, Corey. If you're equals and you didn't invite somebody or they didn't invite you, like, how do you guys decide who shoots?
Man, yeah, if it's equal, like you both haven't shot an elk ever before or whatever, I'll usually draw straws or draw a blade of grass or flip a coin, like just make it the luck of the draw. A lot of times like that, the scenario might play out to where only one person ends up getting the shot. You kind of want to leave it open-minded to that, but yeah, I don't know. Flip a coin. See who's luckier.
That's how we usually roll, unless it's a hunt where maybe I've already got to go on a hunt and they don't have as much time or freedom and this is their one hunt of the year. You know, you extend some, you know, you extend that offer to them, like, no, go ahead and start. And then you do every other day. We don't like to both carry our bows around. It's like you focus on what you're supposed to do. I'll focus on, and the chances of us getting a shot at a second bull, there is always that chance, but it's never really, you know, shown itself. So we usually pack one bow, the other guy's responsible for the calls and the raking and the brushing, and then that way we can just kind of avoid you know, two people trying to get shots or you know, not doing any of that. And just like you, we usually either do like one full day, that way we don't have to get back to camp, or if it's like a rifle hunt, we'll do like a night and a morning. But usually once you flip the coin and get going, or however you want to do it, just come up with a system. And you know, you're hunter one day and then you're caller the next, and you just switch throughout the hunt. And rifle mule deer, of course, we're not in a mule deer podcast. Like if it's rifle mule deer, we'll just play whoever spots it, shoots it the entire time, you know? So it keeps everybody on the glass all the time versus a guy thinking he's going to take a nap or whatnot, which is another good incentive, you know, is if you spot it or locate it or find it, then you're up. It just incentivizes, you know, getting after it and staying after it throughout the whole hunt.
Yeah. It makes you work a little harder.
This is a question which I've got a good answer for, but I'll see how you answer. His second question, also from Holden Kuhn, he wants to be a better caller, but feels he lacks the lung capacity or the ability to call either long or loud enough. Is there a way to improve that?
Well, to get louder, he should get the Phelps metal bugle tube. Can't get much louder than that. My ears ring every time I blow that thing personally.
Yeah.
Man, I don't know. There's probably some lung exercises you could do. You know, I know a lot of folks struggle, say they're coming from lower elevation, they go into higher elevation. It can take them a few days to just get their lungs back up and running, especially if they're hiking the hills and working really hard. It could be hard for anybody to blow a bugle when your blood's pumping like that. But man, there's probably some lung exercises you can do. Take some, just, you know, leading up to a hunt, do some lung stretches. Not only are you, should you be mentally and physically preparing, but also preparing those lungs for what have you. And then just all in all, practice bugling and cow calling.
And that's was going to be my two-part answer. As we do design calls, the Easy Bugler attached to an aluminum or metal bugle tube, very, very loud. And it requires less air than being able to run a diaphragm. So there are calls that will get you the ability to be a better caller or to be louder if that's what you're after. And then one thing you may never, let me back up. Just by running calls a lot, like we've been able to be at lots of sportsman shows. We've been around guys that seem to start the show as like a mediocre caller. And then just being in the booth for a week, half into bugle. It's just like anything. The more you do it, the more your lungs are going to become adapted. They're going to be more comfortable and you're going to be able to bugle louder, cleaner, all of that stuff. And we've noticed it at the shows where a guy comes in, it's like, oh, I don't know if we want him bugling on a call, you know, or blowing on a call, cause it's not really good for sales, but just being around good callers, and doing it over and over. And by the end, you're like, that guy got a lot better, you know? And then the last thing I wanted to touch base on lung capacity is one thing, and I'm going to nerd out on people here for a little bit, is it's fairly tied. There is a very high, correlation with your age and your height, not your weight, not anything else. So like a lot of the air capacity, lung capacity charts that I look at when I'm modeling a bugle tube, will have the age. I don't remember how all the axes are laid out, but basically age and your height will then dictate like your max capacity, like output from your lungs. So it's one thing that as you get older, you're going to have less. If you're short, you're already at a disadvantage just based on the correlation. But one thing I found is maybe that doesn't necessarily add up because we've got small guys that can crank. So maybe it's a different, a different capacity that your lungs have. But I would say to stop BSing about this long drawn out answer is just practice a lot. The more you run a call, the better you're going to get it running a call, the more control you're going to have over that call. And that'll kind of fix it for you.
Well, man, fitness, getting ready for an elk hunt, you know, is going to help your lungs, stretch them out, get them stronger, get that fire out of them the first couple of hikes up a steep hill with a heavy backpack. I don't see how that would hurt your lungs to be able to call a little bit longer and louder.
Yep. And allows you to call without taking a minute break. So you can finally, after you get done with it, actually still blow on the tube when you're grinding it out is also another thing. Like, you know, I've ran into, like, I need 10 seconds before I can blow on there, 20 or 30, you know, and the better shape you're in, the better you're going to be. So our second question comes from Nick in Utah, which obviously listens to the show because he starts out, I know you don't use a decoy very much, if ever, but I was wondering if you've ever tried using a decoy for elk hunting in the low country of junipers and pinyons before. If not, how could or would you use a strategy? And what would it look like in your eyes if this was used? Would it be effective? And then is there a strategy where you wouldn't use this tactic? So go ahead and answer that. Have you ever decoyed, Corey?
I have not. But man, I really want to. There's been many scenarios where I wish I had a decoy because I think it would have lured them in just that much further because, you know, they're pretty keen on coming into the sound of a cow or a bull, coming in and curious. But a lot of times if they don't see anything, that just triggers their nervousness to not come in any closer. And man, it's happened way too many times where they get hung up at that 60, 70, 80 yard mark. And I believe if a decoy was behind me or behind the shooter, then that would bring him in, you know, that extra 20 yards needed. No, I haven't ever used one actually in the field. I guess I don't want to carry one around because I end up climbing 12 to 15 miles a day.
Yep. I'm in the same boat. We've tried to take them and we've lost her before we've ever got to use it on two different hunts. So somewhere out there, there's an elk decoy out there. But I just thinking about it, I wouldn't want to use it in wide open country where, you know, things can look out of place. I think the situation they're talking about, that Nick's talking about, like low country junipers, pinions, as long as it's tight enough and not wide open and can be seen from hundreds of yards away, it would work. And then it works even better in maybe tight timber, where if they can get a glimpse, you know, when they're at 70 or 80 yards or 100 yards, but real tight. And I'm going to, you know, roll into why I think that a lot of times those bulls will hold up where they expect to see that cow, or where that cow can then see them, and they expect that cow to go to them, right? Because they don't want to leave their herd. And so if you're giving the bull the ability, or whatever you're trying to call the ability, to see this cow from 200 or 300 yards away, he's going to sit out there, most likely, not always, but he, in my opinion, he's going to sit out there and bugle and then just not come in to within shooting range. Versus if there is no visual and that bull can't lay eyes on that cow decoy, you may have better options. So I think it really depends on how tight the vegetation is, when that bull will finally be able to see that decoy. And then, you know, but like I say, I'm just guessing at what would happen. You could have a bull that has no cows and he's always looking for a cow. He may run right into that setup, versus a herd bull may not be willing to come any closer, you know, and leave his cows for just a lone cow that's out there calling to him. He expects her to come to him. And so I don't have a great answer for that either, but I think you wouldn't want to use it in wide open country. You'd want it to be at least relatively tight enough that bull would have to be somewhat close to see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Engage his curiosity just enough to bring him in that much closer, for sure.
Yep. Yep. And then our last question, I believe, comes from Corey Bonin. He was wondering if we've ever covered the topic on post rut. He lives in Alberta, Canada, hunts elk in the foothills of the Rockies, and he says it seems to be the rut actually starts to taper off by the third week of September, and their rifle season up there starts on September 17th. And he says by the time they get to October, they're hard pressed to get any bugles. What are the best tactics for kind of that post rut? For, you know, kind of going back to what we've already talked about, you know, still pretty decent bugling into October, but let's say you had a tag for middle October and still wanted to run calls or use that to your advantage. Like, what would be your strategy?
Man, there has to be a fired up bull somewhere, but yeah. Having to hunt in an area where a few rifle shots have already gone off, that'll shut some elk up for sure. You and I, Jason, have both hunted in the Bob Marshall Wilderness, where we can hunt with rifles September 15th. And those first few days are fire, but then when they hear a couple of rifle shots go off, they're a little less apt to scream at the top of their lungs. You can still find them out there. You just might have to dig a little deeper and get a little further back, maybe where people haven't been. I don't know. I don't think it's worth giving up on just the same tactics, hunting ridges, bugling, looking for that one that might still be fired up in there, because that's still early enough. Obviously, it varies by regions. North to south, especially, but man, there's got to be one fired up somewhere. I don't think it's worth giving up on the calling.
Yeah, and elk are just, they've got that built-in safety feature, right, where they do hear those gunshots. We can't have a conversation with Corey here, Corey Bonin, not you. It's like, are these elk just non-existent, or are you still seeing them? They're just not bugling. That'd be nice to know. But my guess is these elk are going back to some hidey holes, right? They're trying to get away from pressure. They still maybe, you know, you may need to go find those. It's tough to figure that out. But as far as strategy, like, I use my bugle fairly religiously, you know, into the middle of October if I was hunting, Rockies. You know, it's like I will probably get a response if there are cows in the area that are still coming into estrus, or even if not, like, he still may be willing to try to find that last cow. He may answer you. And then as far as calling a bull into range, you know, we're pretty heavy buglers, but I would maybe switch a little more to cow calls at that point, especially if you've got a rifle in your hand. You know, I just got off of a rifle rut hunt, and it's tough to, like, remove myself from my archery tactics, knowing it's like, hey, we got a gun, you know, we're hunting with a gun now. I don't need to call this bull into range. I don't need to risk getting winded. I don't need to get tight. Like, I just need to know where he's at, and then we'll find him. And so, that's where I would say if you're rifle hunting by September 17th already, I would bugle and locate and then turn it into a, you know, a spot the bull and try to get in position to shoot it. Not necessarily call that thing all the way in. Now, like I say, I don't know where they're at. They might be in heavy timber and I might be saying stuff that's just not useful to them, mm-hmm. but that would be my go-to is, you know, hunt them like you've got a rifle and maybe some of this stuff we always talk about getting them into archery range. It's just too much risk at that point.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Yeah, maybe to sum that up, just spot, maybe shifted more towards spot and stock, but to be able to spot them with either your glass or if you can just locate them, get one to screw up by bugling or cow calling and then stock in from there, get a few hundred yards away. Got a high advantage with that high powered rifle.
Yep. Yep. So, well, thanks everybody for your questions. If you, like I said earlier, if you have questions for us, our guests, myself, email us at ctd@phelpsgamecalls.com or send us social media messages. We're on all the platforms there. Make sure to get them over and we'll try to get them included here in our show. So,
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meat eater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meat eater.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land? Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today. Because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth.
Now we're going to jump into my discussion with you, Corey. Tell me a little bit about where you guided, kind of how long you've been doing, how you got into it, a little background on yourself, and then we'll roll into some questions on your clientele and the elk that you got to hunt.
Yeah, well, let's see. Fresh out of high school, I started guiding elk hunters. My first year was down in Colorado, which, as everybody knows, has an extremely high elk population versus the other western states out here. And it's true, there's a lot of elk down there. We went 64 for 64 in the archery and rifle seasons that I went down there. Not all bulls. We never shot one over 320 inches that year, but man, there's just a lot of elk roaming those mountains. Very impressive. Was signed up to go back down that next year when I was going to be 19, but ended up landing a job in the Bob Marshall Wilderness, much closer to where I was born and raised in Northwest Montana, and couldn't pass up the opportunity. It started out as guiding fishermen in the Bob. And then we have an early rifle season back there. It opens September 15th with a rifle. And it was kind of always a dream to go back in there to hunt personally. My folks had lived in Montana since the 70s and went back in there on some DIY hunts on their own. And just hearing those stories, always wanted to put my boots in the wilderness. And this was a good chance to do it and get paid to do it. So I guided deep in the wilderness for 7 years. Learned a lot about elk hunting. I was young. That was my early 20s. And then just kind of through the grapevine of working in the industry, was able to land a pretty fantastic guiding job just north of Bozeman here where I live now on a couple different private ranches that honestly are the total opposite spectrum of elk hunting, going from deep in the wilderness, having to earn just getting back there, mandatory 9 to 10 miles on a horse just to enter the wilderness unit versus shooting elk off the hood of a truck, not literally, of course, but pretty close, and then loading them in whole with a wench, an electric wench in the back of the truck. Pretty mind-blowing spectrum to go from one to the other. That first year guiding on one of the private ranches up here, had to send video of the first bull I harvested. It was a 351-inch bull that I helped harvest, guided, and I wenched the whole thing in the back of a truck, was able to drive right to it. And had to record the video, send that to all my buddies who were still grinding it out in the wilderness. And they all, I'm pretty sure, puked on their phones when they saw that. But so I was pretty spoiled from there, but definitely earned my stripes, I would say, to get to that point. And yeah, two very different spectrums of guiding. And I spent 8 years guiding on these ranches that I'm speaking of.
Yeah. So you've got it sounds like you got a real contrast from doing it maybe as hard and as far away from the truck as you can versus doing it as close and maybe, I don't want to say easy, but, definitely the odds are stacked in your favor more on that private land. You know, it's managed to be that versus, the unmanaged wilderness, semi unmanaged wilderness that you just kind of get what you get and the terrain gets thrown at you and whatnot. And
exactly.
So quick story about me. I don't know if I tried to be a guide, an elk hunting guide right out of high school. And my parents gave me the ultimatum of like, this is where we break your plate. Like if you go to college and go do all of that, you get to, you can stay here and finish out your college. Or if you go do that, like you're kind of on your own. And I'm like, gosh, dang it. But no, long story short, I wouldn't trade it for the world. Like the path I got, to being able to sit here and have the conversation with you, we're both in similar spots, but that was my goal out of high school. I wasn't interested in getting what I would call a normal job or doing the normal. I didn't want to go to college, but that was my goal, is to do that guiding right out of high school, but never got to it.
Oh yeah. I never knew that about you.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you got to hunt with a lot of different elk hunters and these, when I say elk hunters, guys and gals that were maybe coming in for different experiences, right? When we booked the Bob, we booked it with the full understanding that if we didn't kill anything, we'd get to see some amazing country, right? And see, but there was still decent elk and deer to be had in there. And then you've got to see people that book on these ranches with the intention of, they probably just want to kill the biggest bull they can as easy as they can do it, be back in the lodge, drinking a whiskey at night, so you've got to see the entire spectrum of elk hunters. Is there like a parallel you can make regardless of whether they're in the wilderness or whether they were down at the ranches that like made a good elk hunter or made a good client, or, is there any parallels you can make there or maybe the major contrasts?
Just trusting your guide, it would have been a major, I guess it kind of switches up your question a little bit, but kind of a great parallel between the two types of clients that just made a guide's job or my life so much easier, was just to listen and trust your guide because they're doing it. They've been doing it. And they're going to ask you for pointers or your opinion on a certain scenario, but just follow the leader. Whether you're on a horseback or in the side of a pickup truck, just trust your guide that he's taking you to the right spot and trying to get you the, most successful outcome that you're paying for, whether it's, $4,000 for a 9-day horseback hunt or $12,000 for a 5-day drive around and spot 100 elk a day hunt. They're very different, but yeah. Does that answer your question? I feel like I pivoted?
Yeah, no. It for the most part, it's a tough question to answer. So I'm going to kind of twist it up a little bit as I present it here. So let's take away the ranch hunt and let's just focus on the public land, grind it out a little bit more physical, a little bit less guaranteed by far. When you were up in the Bob, like what do those hunters, let's say you're coming from out east, you've never experienced the west, or like what do these people need to be prepared for? Like what would be your best guidance, you know, for them to hit the ground running and maybe be successful?
100% physical stamina, like start preparing physically early on. That country we're in is very hard on people. I guided people who had the sheep grand slam on their walls that elk hunt kicked their butt. It's pretty rugged terrain, and any elk terrain, whether you're leaving the pickup every morning or going deep in on horseback or whatever, elk live in really rugged terrain. So just physically being fit, having your stamina as high as you think you can handle it. You know, you owe the respect to the animal to say you shoot something and doesn't drop right away. You owe that animal a lot to be able to continue to grind and try and recover that thing. Don't give up on it. Also mental stamina as well, not only physical, but mental. If you got, whether it's 5 days or 10 days designated and something happens early, or it's just the hunt's not going your way, luck's not having it, just stay in the game and stay at it. Mental and physical stamina is so important for elk hunting.
Yeah. And one thing, I mean, I'm going to take a little side approach, but even the physical side that we rode, there was a fire the year I went in there and we had to come in a different direction. So we were on the horses or mules for 30 plus miles. There were a few of us that had been working out fairly heavily and we were okay because we walked about 8 miles and walked our horses for another 22 or whatever, you know, plus or minus a few miles. It was before, you know, dark to after dark sort of a ride. There were some of the guys in our crew that couldn't walk the next day just because of the horse ride. And, you know, guys that aren't horse guys or mule guys, and the guys that were in better shape and had been working out, we were sore, but we were able to go, you know? And so it's like, it all tied in, like something I never would have thought preparing for a hunt, because I'm not a horse guy, I'm not a mule guy, but you need that to be able to access that country. Like the physical went as far is that, and then these guys that maybe needed some breaks, like the very next day we didn't need to recoup from our base camp. Then we spiked out an additional 5 miles because that's where we thought, and these other guys were like, oh no, we'll do it later in the hunt. And we went, you know, we were there to go be successful. And that was kind of our mindset. And that's where, you know, we always look at physical and mental as different, but I would always argue that a lot of your mental will come from physically challenging yourself, because that's usually where you start to question your mental starts to come into play, as you're sore, your feet hurt, you're tired, you know, you're hungry, this or that. And so you let that physical ability like start to affect your mental. You know, like, well, I'm going to just hunt around camp today. Not saying it's not it's better than not hunting at all, but it's also not as good as climbing back up to the top of the mountain, you know, where you think the critters might be or whatnot. And so, my advice is always getting as good a physical shape as you can, and it's going to limit your exposure to that like mental, you know, breakdown or your ability to talk yourself out of something. And then I'm going to add one more piece onto that, like good hunting partners. I'd be lying to say that I'm always like at the very top physically or at the very top mentally. There are times where you need a hunting partner that's just as dedicated to the cause as you, or somebody you can, you know, pitch ideas off of. And at times when maybe I'm not feeling it, they'll pick you up. And when they're feeling down or out or don't want to give it the extra effort, you're like, no, we need to go up there. And at least the group that I run with, like we push each other so hard that you never want to let the other guy down. And so it's nice to be able to like, no, we're going up there and you're going with me, whether you want to or not.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Picking great partners for that is key. And if you're ever going on a guided hunt, usually, typically not always, but your guides, you know, that guy who's waking you up in the mornings, getting you going in the afternoons, keeping your head up.
Yep. I didn't realize, and I feel for the, I understand why we took the 2 hour naps, because I needed it anyways, but those guys are out wrangling hobbled horses and mules at like 3 in the morning while we're still sleeping. Then they get you up at 4:30, and it's just, by the time they're done taking care of the horses, like, you guys deserve a bigger tip than I gave, you know. And it was my good buddy, but I'm like, gosh dang, you know, these cooks are up at 3 in the morning starting your meals or lunches or whatever. And I don't know, it's not for the faint of heart. You better not need sleep to be able to survive.
No, it's a lot of hard work for sure. Late nights, long days. I mean, you'd sneak in a little nap midday, kind of, you know, you want cool, you know, kind of overcast weather, you know, consistent weather, but you also kind of hope for really hot weather so you can sneak in that 2 or 3 hour nap while the elk are laying down midday, whatever it takes. But it's a lot of hard work. But yeah, it's you don't see too many older, like, especially wilderness hunting guides. It's a young man's sport, career. But I wouldn't trade it for the world. Those were the times back then, man.
Yeah. All right. So let's diverge a little bit from the clients, and I'm more interested in the elk, the differences that maybe lived, you know, 30 miles from anywhere, you know, elk that never seen a person compared to these elk that live on a place that was pretty much designed for their, for them to flourish, get as big as possible, carry the absolute highest carrying capacity you can, versus the opposite of just, you know, being in the middle of the bog or some remote Colorado wilderness where they're just given with what's on the ground. Are there any major differences when you'd go to hunt those elk as far as the elk are concerned, or are they different creatures as far as being able to call them, pattern them, whatnot?
You know, it's hard to say. My original answer just now was going to be that elk on some of the private land obviously don't have the pressure as much as public land, say, whether it's deep in the wilderness or just your typical national forest trailhead. But elk on private land don't seem to run away as far. Now, they're elk. They're skittish. You bump them once, that's probably your only opportunity. But a lot of times they know where the border of that private and public land is, and they don't want to go to public, because last time they did that, they just got bumped right back onto to private, even if those ranches are being hunted and hunted hard, you know, with multiple clients every week. They still know where the border is, and they don't necessarily want to leave. Now, it's what makes me backtrack that answer a little bit is, in the vast open public land, wilderness, what have you, you bump an elk and you're looking at such crazy massive country that you're not going to ever be able to catch up to that. Where on a big private ranch, yeah, you can, you know, give it a half a day and then drive your truck over there and be to the other end of the ranch where that elk headed, you know, within an hour or so. So I think just it's the terrain, whether it's private or public. If an elk runs away from you or goes over a ridge that just doesn't look passable, to your stamina or your whereabouts, whether you're on foot, horse, or vehicle, that's probably the biggest difference, is just the terrain for the elk and for the hunter.
Yeah. And one thing that, you know, being able to hunt, I haven't got to hunt, I have hunted some private land, but like the ability to pattern those elk, right? Because those elk on private, mm-hmm. like, we know they're probably going to go bed here. They're probably going to come out and feed here, versus sometimes up in the mountains, you know, if a cougar or a wolf runs through there, I mean, it could happen on public or the private chunk as well, but it seems like, you know, the private stuff, they're maybe a little more patternable, a little more predictable, versus up in the mountains. It's like they may feed in this section one day, and then for some reason the lead cow takes them to a different spot the next day to feed, or they're in, like, you know, a 3 or 4 day rotation, you know, versus, and one thing that I've heard, and maybe you can, you know, solidify this answer, is like a lot of times on these ranches, they won't let you go hunt them in bed, right? Because they do not want you to disturb them. They want that pattern to be the same. You get your one shot in the morning while the wind's right, the bull goes in there, you're taking the afternoon off. Versus in the mountains, it's like, you know, everybody on the mountain that spotted any elk going into a bedding area are going to get bumped or killed, one or the other. It's like, for the majority of guys, right, they're going to go in there and keep chasing elk until they either bump them or kill them. And so that's one nice thing where it's managed a little bit better. And I never fault anybody for going a little bit harder on public ground or mountainous ground, because that's your opportunity, right? But mm-hmm. that is one thing where I think that private land ranch stuff, whereas if you've got rules in place that make sure that those elk don't necessarily get ran out of there, is a pretty good system that their pattern stays the same for quite a while.
Yeah, that's very true. Well, yeah, I guided on two different ranches here in central Montana. And yeah, the latter one that I've guided on, if you weren't back for breakfast by 11 a.m., like if you didn't have an elk on the ground, the outfitters started getting a little suspicious that you were maybe hunting a bedding zone or something. That was definitely rule number one, was don't hunt the bedding zones. You bump an elk out of his bed, he's not coming back for a while. And that was the last thing we wanted. We wanted those elk to stay there, to feel somewhat comfortable. And your opportunity in the morning and the evening was so great, whether we were sitting tree stands, sitting by wallows, or spotting stock, trying to be in the right place at the right time. It was very open country. And of course, the elk are going to come out to those openings in the middle of the night. And then where they would go in was the limited bedding areas, and those were just do not enter
off limits.
Didn't want to be invited back, and you wanted to be invited back as a client or a guide. It was a cool place to hunt.
And I think that lesson can maybe translate into public, right? I mean, we talk about hunting bedding areas, and we talk about like midday magic, you know, that you can get into, but there is something to be taken away. Like if you want those elk to continue their patterns and do what they did the day before and where you found them, going into their bedding area could potentially change their patterns if you bump them or blow them out of where they think a safe, secure spot is. So I mean, this is a great way to reiterate, like go in very cautiously, whether you're on public, because you know, the guides and the ranches are running the system for a reason, to make sure those elk continue to do what they've did.
Yeah. You know, for days past. Smart. It's a smart system. Yeah. So if you got time and you watch one go into a bedding zone, yeah, maybe if you don't, you know, if it's dry and crunchy, leave them be. But if it's wet, drizzling, and you might be able to sneak in, take your boots off, maybe it's worth going in there, especially if you're limited on time. But yeah, you got to make that tough decision.
So this will be a good segue. I'm going to ask you, and then we're going to talk about some of the hard, you know, it's sometimes hard to talk about elk hunting, right? Because we've been doing it for so long. Some of it's just kind of ingrained into our thought process, but can you define what makes a good time to go into a bedding area? Is there like a few things you check off a checklist where you will go into a bedding area, or how does that decision come about? Or there's just so many factors we can't hardly talk about them.
I don't know. A few of the main factors, I'd say how many eyeballs just went in there. You know, if it's a bull and I don't know, more than four cows that went in there, that's a lot of eyeballs you're trying to sneak in on. Unless you can, I think that your ultimate scenario would be if you're like, say, across a ravine and you can see how they're bedded, exactly where they're at, find yourself a little ambush route. You know, you're fairly confident in which way the wind's blowing in there, then you're set. But man, yeah, the number of eyeballs, and then also how loud it is, how crunchy the leaves and the pine needles are going to be. You can always, I've taken my boots off 100 times trying to sneak in on an elk, and it's worked a couple times. I even took my britches off once just so I didn't have my legs
swiping
back and forth. That time it did not work. I was caught in the middle of a herd of elk running away with my pants down. No pun intended.
literally.
But man, yeah, eyeballs and the how dry it is, man. If you can get in somewhere where you know where he's at or where your target is at, and if it's like drizzling rain, your scent's not pushing around as much, you got a pretty good chance of getting close anyway.
Yep. No, I like it. We've tried to approach a lot, but a lot of times we get turned away, like brush on the entry. We're going to have to be noisy to get in. Like if I've got good elk trails going, and like you said, there weren't any satellite bulls, that's one thing that I almost always abandon the mission if there's a satellite bull, because inevitably, and it makes total sense when you think about it, that satellite bull doesn't get to bed with the herd, right? That herd bull will. And that satellite bull almost always gets kicked downwind of that. And so when we're approaching to be good elk hunters, we're going to come in with the wind in our face so those elk can't smell us. But guess what elk you run into about 150 yards out? You run into that damn satellite bull almost every time we've tried to approach that way. And so if we know there are a bunch of satellite bulls around, it's proceed at your own risk. Like how late in the hunt is it? How quick you need to try to make something happen? If you've got a lot of time left, we usually just leave it alone. But
yeah.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meat eater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meat eater.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today. Because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth.
This is a great segue into what we kind of talked about this a little bit before we started recording. We talk about elk hunting and all of these are like very cookie cutter examples, right? We say the wind's doing this or the elk are doing this, but a lot of times, like, what's the moon doing? Has it rained for the last week? Are the elk rutting? Are there cows in heat? How big are the herds? How many satellite bulls? Like, all of these things boil in to our answers, and it makes it talking about archery elk hunting, it makes it difficult. And I think that's why we a lot of times just talk about our system, right? It's easier for me to talk about the system, but then all of these variables still come into play. And one thing I got a question the other day is what makes a good elk hunter, or in your opinion, we were talking about it around a campfire on the elk hunt that I was just on. And I kind of came up with this is I think most successful elk hunters have a system that they use. They stick to it for most part of the hunt. But the one thing I've found out is if you look at all the successful elk hunters, their systems aren't necessarily always similar. And so I was trying to boil that down, like, how does all that work? And so what I've really kind of said is rather than try to play every variable all the time, like, just stick with if you're a caller, call. If you're a spot and stalker, spot. If you're, what have you found, Corey, as far as like what makes somebody successful year in and year out? You know, you are typically always able to kill your elk or help buddies kill their elk, fill their tags. In your opinion, like, what makes a good elk hunter and consistent?
I brought it up earlier. I think just the both physical and mental stamina. Odds are it's not going to happen right away, or even where your plan A or even B spots are going to be. So being able to stay with it mentally and physically, obviously, and grind it out. Don't just stop in your plan A or B spot. Say some other folks are there. There's just not elk happening. It feels like the rut hasn't started, or it feels like it could be a little late. Maybe switch it up. Be a little bit more open to try a new area, whether that means driving somewhere or having to hike, move camp. I think just kind of keeping it open-minded, you know, not having the tunnel vision for one plan. You know, having a great plan A, plan B is important, but man, have a X, Y, and Z plan too. Hopefully you give yourself more than just a weekend. Obviously if you can get out every weekend of the season, that's great, but give yourself 5 to 10 days for an area and don't assume that it's all going to happen right then and there. So I think just being open-minded and then having that mental and physical stamina to last your, you know, allotted hunt window is really important. And that's something that I've noticed I've been able to do. Was younger, it was frustrating not having plan A or B go right, but just being, you know, knowing that you can't control Mother Nature and having a plan X and Y in your back pocket is super important. And eventually it's going to work out for you. Maybe not with meat in the freezer, but at least have a heck of a hunt.
Yep. And that's one thing we learned as we started. You know, I grew up industrial timberlands, hunting around home. You packed your lunch for the day. As I started to venture out and hunt what I'd consider more mountainous, more adventurous type elk hunting, you know, we would go in like, well, how are we going to carry all of our food? You know, we hadn't had it dialed in. So we would pack 10 days of food into one camp 6 miles in. Well, guess what that did? That locked me into an area for the entire time. And it's like, well, then you were basing your stay based on, well, your food's already all in here, or, you know, this is what we had planned on doing for 10 days versus where I'm at now, where I pack maybe a half a day's food. I can live off of it for 2 days. And if there are elk there in that half a day, I know I'm going to be back at the truck going to a different trailhead or a different area, you know. And it sounds so cliche and we say it over and over, but you need to be able to like pull the plug and not be married to an area or a spot because it looks good on Onyx. It looks good on Google Earth. It looks good wherever. If there aren't elk there on that year, so if I can't go into a spot and find very fresh rubs, very fresh sign, elk scat, you know, whatever, like I'm out. And especially if you can't add a live elk to those tracks, you know, a bugle or spot them with your glasses, I'm out of there. And one thing, you know, I think people overlook is like, well, it looks kind of fresh. I'm like, well, that once that elk crap or track, you know, if it hasn't rained or whatnot and washed it out, like those elk could have been there 2 weeks ago. And in the month of September, those things are moving. If they got bumped out of there, they might've went a drainage over and never came back. Like you just might be in the wrong spot. So yeah, I feel that being willing to move, get out of a spot, go try plans, you know, B through Z or whatever it needs to be, like, have the ability to open up Onyx or whatever mapping software you use, say, well, I think this spot might be good. It's going to take me, you know, hour and a half to hike in this 3 miles. This is where I want to be, and go try it out that night. Mm-hmm. You know, and one thing we talk about is if you need the third part of the day, like go locate at nighttime, like do whatever you got to do, but you need to find some elk, and just keep moving zones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even if it means changing mountain ranges, you know, at least where elk tend to live in the Rocky Mountain West, you got a lot of options. And any, you know, unless you have a trophy unit tag where you're restricted to a certain zone, you're just carrying a general elk tag in your pocket, man, you got a lot of country to explore. So go check something new out. You might have had a great spot that was great last year, was great the year before, historically a great zone. They're not there this year. Switch it up. Or also stick to it. You know, if it's been a good spot, they might just not be in there yet. You know, I've been amazed by the number of times where I've given up on a spot. Well, not 100% given up, but like, man, tomorrow I'm leaving if I don't see anything in the morning. And sure enough, a huge herd of elk moved in overnight, and there they are. So it's tough what to say, you know, flip a coin to make a decision, because it's a lot of skill, but man, there's a lot of luck involved. Don't forget that.
For sure. So we're recording this on September 5th. We both just came off of, you know, you got to hunt a little bit over Labor Day weekend. I just came off of a hunt Labor Day weekend. And one, or actually two of the things we were dealing with on for both of us is the moon. We're coming up, we were at a full moon on Thursday, I believe, which was August 31st. And then we rolled in, we got a bunch of weather Thursday, Friday, and then coming from Washington, it hit you guys, what, Saturday, Sunday, I think?
Yeah, Sunday, Monday.
Yep. So you guys got the weather after us. So next thing I want to talk about is your opinion on, does the moon matter, and how that affects it versus, and then we'll jump into the rain and that system that rolled through.
Yeah. Don't hunt during a full moon, stay home. Elk aren't even out in the woods. I don't know where they go, but no, I'm totally kidding. I'm sure it affects them. And I've always had this theory that, whenever like the second, third, fourth week of September lines up with a full moon, that's going to be kind of towards the peak rut. The elk get to do their dance during the evening twilight hours while they can see a little bit better. They get to roam a little bit more. I don't know if that theory is true, has any truth to it or not, but man, when elk are fired up, they're fired up. And if it's the third week of September or wherever, you know, kind of the peak time might be for your region, whether it's a full moon or a new moon, I don't think it matters. Honestly, I haven't noticed anything. I've killed elk on a full moon and I've killed elk on a new moon. It's hard to tell what it is. I know it's easier to sleep with a new moon because it kind of keeps you up at night when it's full blasting in your eyeballs. But yeah, I don't know. 14 years of guiding, 20 plus years of just hunting myself, I haven't noticed, at least in September, a difference with the moon.
I'm right there with you. And I just kind of sum it all up is there's only so many days in September. I'm going to be out there as much as possible. The one thing that throws a little bit of a wrench in my system is maybe somebody contacts me with, I've only got 1 week to hunt. Mm-hmm. And then do you put them around the moon? I usually don't. I still say, what are you after? Like, do you want peak of the rut? Then you have to be there on this week, regardless of whether the moon's there or not. That's when you're going to get your most action, your most bugling. And so, I don't pay a whole lot of attention to the moon. And this is going to show everybody how big of a nerd I am. I had went back, I looked at a bunch of trail cameras and then like timed it with what the moon was on that and what time they were showing up at a specific wallow. And it didn't really matter when the full moon was there. They showed up a little bit later. They didn't, they weren't coming in the daylight and they left a little bit earlier, but it really didn't affect things through the end of August into like the middle of September, I think is when we ran that cam. And then I had just looked at like there for a stretch of like the 10 bulls I had killed. That was like from, I don't even remember, 2005 to 2015. And I had looked at all the bulls that I had killed and almost all of them were within 4 or 5 days of a full moon. It's just how it landed, how it had added up. And, you know, some were on the front side. Some people, you know, the moon, the guys that claim the moon really matters always say that you want to be on the backside of the full moon, you know, tailing off, but it was 5 days before, 5 days after, it didn't really seem to matter. There was no correlation with when I killed and what the moon was doing.
Interesting. Well, I know you brought it up that this was going to be our next topic, so this kind of segues, but I certainly think weather has more drastic involvement with elk habits versus the moon.
Yeah. So what's your opinion on like a rain system or a snow system that moves in? Let's say, you know, it's been decent weather, rain moves in. In your opinion, or what have you seen that do to the elk or the rut?
Man, what I've seen, consistent weather, whether it's rain or dry, is key. So, you know, having a week of rain, they're still going to do their thing. But having a week of dry and then all of a sudden a rainstorm comes in, I've certainly noticed it shut down, or at least it feels like it shuts down. I always assume that estrus smell, the cows breeding, that scent in the air just kind of gets locked down with that moisture in the air is what I've always assumed. But man, I've chased elk that have bugled all day long in a heavy rain that turned to snowstorm. Two bulls dueling it out for about 30 or 40 cows all day. Never been able to get close enough to the bulls. Could have shot a few of the cows many times, but that didn't affect them one bit. And it was a snow rainstorm that came in after some 80 degree heat. And then it was the next day. So I've kind of seen it all, but it does seem like the rain that kind of comes out of nowhere and breaks up a dry week, at least in September. You know, we're still dealing with some warmer temps right now versus say later October, November, that it does affect them. Whether they just don't want to dance in the rain or the scent or something, but it's still worth going out, no doubt.
Yep. And my experience is almost mirrored yours, that it's not so much the consistent rain or the consistent sun, but it's that change. And within like 3 days of that change, you know, it's on the tail end of it. So for instance, we haven't had rain for 90 plus days or something like that. We're getting ready to go hunting, and Thursday we get that downpour before we leave, and it really quieted things down to compared to what everybody said that the elk were doing that unit, and they slowly started picking back up as the weather was getting nice again. And the same thing, I think if it's been raining for you know 5, 6, 7 days, the elk are getting used to it, and all of a sudden you get a high pressure move in and it gets nice, it's like, all right, it takes a couple more days for things to like get back into normal. And, you know, so we've had, you know, up in the high country, we've got snow a little bit, and it seems to be more of like middle ground. It doesn't seem to, for some reason, snap them in or out as much as rain versus sun, but that's just maybe my limited experience in the high country, but it seems like the rut just kind of continues on, at least in the snow. I don't know why or how come, but just from my experience, the snow didn't seem to affect them as much as the rain.
Yeah, no, I know. And you can't pick the dates necessarily, you can't pick the weather of a hunt that you've had planned for weeks, months, or years even. But, you know, an ideal weather condition would be just like consistent 60 or 70s, maybe a little chance of rain here or there. But, you know, if you're crossing your fingers for weather, just hope for consistency for sure.
Yep. Yeah. I like that. Like, overcast with a little, you know, 50% cloud cover, good, you know, mid temps, cool in the morning, crisp in the morning, and then, you know, maybe heat up to 60 or 70 in the afternoon. Like that's my favorite. The other thing I hate systems coming in and out is because it screws with your wind on both ends of it, right? Is you get these pushes. Now all of a sudden you're not just dealing with the local thermals. You're now dealing with these crazy swirling winds. It's just a headache to deal with.
And that's possible. You got to wonder if that affects the elk, you know, their habits. They get a little nervous when they're so used to that southwest wind, at least here in Montana, prevailing winds southwest. And then all of a sudden it's out of the northeast. They're like, oh, I got to, you know, change my location where I'm going to feel comfortable during the day. I'm not going to talk as much. It must affect them as well. So yeah, you definitely got to change up your tactics.
Yeah. I mean, not that we need to think like an elk, but we've all watched them in the morning. They go from their feed to their bed, and then they bed down, and then they go from their bed to their feed. Well, one thing that I didn't think about a whole lot is a lot of times they let that wind switch, and they're feeding with whatever predator would be in front of them. They're feeding out into that wind, right? And they're doing it. They're not dumb. They're always smelling what's ahead of them, whether their eyes can pick it up or not, but they typically will feed with the wind in their face. That way they can smell any danger that they're walking into. Well, like you had just mentioned, you switch the wind on them 180 degrees. Well, now that bedding and feeding area connection is like broken up, right? They can't do that. They've got to go to a different feeding bedding area combo or connection. And so it really, and maybe that's why it really kind of throws their pattern off. But yeah, I've noticed that, you know, wind switches, or you've hunted an area for 2 or 3 days, you about got it figured out, and all of a sudden some weather moves in and your plan that you'd, you know, been building is completely thrown out the window. You can't do it anymore because the wind's goofy and they're uncomfortable and they've changed their pattern.
Yeah. Well, it's a question as old as time. Every elk that I try and ask, or at least that I try and get close enough to ask the question, they seem to be dead on the ground. So I never get the chance to ask them. But one of these days, maybe I'll get to whisper in an elk's ear and ask them what's up with their habits.
Yeah, I wish I could figure all that out. I'd be a lot better elk hunter, I think, than just taking a guess at all this stuff or what's worked one time, but then it doesn't work the next 20 times. That's the only thing that's like a given when it comes to elk hunting, is that it's never going to be the same from time to time, scenario to scenario. I feel like you can have all the factors exactly the same on scenario A versus B, and the results will be different just because of that elk's personality or something that elk just isn't going to do the same thing. And that's, I mean, I don't claim to know, but I feel that there's some of that goes on, where one bull might be full of piss and vinegar that you're trying to hunt, and one bull might just want to avoid any confrontation. And one thing us as elk hunters need to figure out is how do you deal with each one based on the way they bugle, the way they react to calling, the way they react by just watching them through binos. And that's some more of this stuff we talked about earlier, which I kind of stumbled through on how to describe it, is that all of these little tips and tactics get like brought into the decisions. Like, well, that bull's super hesitant. Or you see a bull over there, like trying to rip a satellite's head off. Anytime it gets within a couple hundred yards, you're like, well, that's a bull I can challenge, you know, or get close to. He just seems pissed versus, you know, one that doesn't really care if a satellite's, I don't know. All of that stuff matters and should affect like your next move when you're out there elk hunting.
Mm-hmm. Keeps you on your toes for sure.
Yep. Yep. So, well, I really appreciate having you on here, Corey. I know you're getting ready to take off for the month of September, and I've got a hunt coming up. So, the best of luck. And, like I say, really appreciate you coming on here and talking elk hunting here.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm excited, man. We'll be in touch. Best of luck to you. I know you got some fun trips planned, or one big epic trip planned for sure. Can't wait to hear how it goes.
Yeah. All right. Well, take care. We'll catch up to you on the backside of hunting season.
Sounds good, Jason. Thanks again.
Outdoor Adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. Simply pour a can in your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more.
You ever get that feeling? The walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins.